Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
You are, and today we're going to talk about how COVID-19 is going to impact our future, or should I just have this mask tattooed on my face? So that's
my question.
You really
want me to answer that question? That would be really gross with that mustache.
It might be stylish. So anyway, part of what we're going to talk about, of course, what we talk about here each week is sustainability. And for those of us who have been lucky enough to be alive during these times, the whole pandemic and COVID-19 has been something we've had to sustain. So I guess the question that I'm posing to you, Miss Annie, is how is this going to impact us into the future? Because at some point it's going to be over, but will it really be over?
Well, it's changing our culture, and what we're really talking about is not sustainable, but it is about resiliency, and that's what we talk about every week here as well. And so what I wanted to do was to look at what some of the experts, if you will, are talking about and thinking about. And most of the things I found were from when the pandemic first started, but I think they're really reflective of where we're going as a culture.
And bearing in mind that experts are normally wrong.
Well, I was just looking for food for thought.
Yeah, okay,
because
well, that's good. This is like a brain exercise.
Okay, thanks.
There you go.
Thanks for that. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that really comes up and is on the minds of many people is, what's the long-term impact in our health? And so for some people who have had the virus, it's a lifetime commitment now, and they're never really going to get over it. But some other positive things that really have come up as opportunities is that the government, first of all, has proven they can do stuff quickly. They've always said, no, we can't, you know, we got this big machine, we got to move it. But that turned out to be a lie, because when they got involved and they thought they were going to get COVID, they were pretty excited. So they've shown that that we can create more sophisticated and be more flexible. We can be more sophisticated and flexible about technology. So, you know, lots of things are happening around telemedicine and doctors online, and also less polarization. So in some cases, we're able to bring groups of people that haven't always had access. We're not doing it great, but we are beginning to move towards bringing more.
When you say polarization, you mean like within the bureaucracy, this group doesn't talk to that group, but now they are?
Well, that may be some of it, but it's also the fact that we see it, what's happened with the pandemic, which lots of us have known, but apparently our culture doesn't care or hasn't cared, is that those who are not in that white educated top 20% or so of people are really left in the dark. So rural people that aren't necessarily considered white, people who don't speak English as their first language, and people who have developmental problems are all on this periphery. And so that's become very clear that they are disproportionately left out of what's needed.
So do you think that the impact of COVID is going to be including them in the decision, or acknowledging the fact that these marginalized groups are marginalized?
Well, they've already acknowledged it, but whether they have the will to do something about it, I don't know.
Well, we'll wait and see. So we'll put that in the column of maybe. Wouldn't it be nice?
I think if it's ever going to happen, this would be
okay.
Now.
All right.
And I also think that we have developed against our will an appreciation of the outdoors and the simple pleasures of not just being outside, but in general, what things we could do that could be healthy, but also bring pleasure to life.
Well, I could comment in that, I guess part of what's sort of formulated in my mind is that I'm more and more aware about how contact with other people can lead to some sort of illness. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be COVID, but it can be, you know, the seasonal flu or a cold. And I start thinking, gosh, you know, really? You mean we used to get in, you know, that close to talk to each other?
Yeah.
and things like that. So I wonder if that's going to, at least for 2 weeks after it's gone, you know, spill over into our consciousness.
Well, I wonder if it has now become second nature not to shake hands or try to touch our faces. But here's what I really think is going to happen is that over the, at least this generation of people in this time, are going to, you know, do silly things like I got to keep washing my hands. So we might have developed some better health habits too. And but on my side of it is that I want us to, I am aware of, you know, the fact that I want to protect others from my germs and from their germs. But I'm also thinking that when this is over in the winter, I might wear a mask. It keeps my face sure. warmer. And also I feel like I have less potential to get sick, but I want to be hugged.
Yeah.
And I want to touch people and I want to hold hands with people and sit next to people and sing with people. And
so those are the things you will not adopt as a behavior.
No, I
strategy.
Won't. I won't be doing
well,
it.
When you're talking about wearing a mask in the winter, I was thinking like, you know, the next time I get on an airplane, you know, well, it's silly not to wear a mask because you remember used to fly all the time. And it's like every time you get off the airplane, you end up sick, you know,
yeah, because people
it
are
is
sick.
A little petri dish.
Yeah. Well, so some other good things is Medicare is now allowed billing for telemedicine, which is apparently a long overdue change, and also using Skype and FaceTime and email to reach people, especially.
Oh, we dearly love that.
Well, no, but I mean in healthcare.
Healthcare?
And
right.
I think that's really amazing because that could also be helpful in not spreading germs, but also with people who are very ill, that adds stress to themselves. So. And I think we're going to move closer to a single payer or some kind of universal health care because it's shown that economically it benefits people. It isn't sure. just individually, but as a society, as a community, we're going to do better economically if we don't have to think about if we get sick, we'll lose our home.
Well, that's a good point, though. Thinking about it from a society level, I mean, look at the economic impact that COVID has had on our economy.
Yeah.
And then if you're just simply out for your own self-interest, keeping the population healthy is good for your business.
Yeah, absolutely. And your employees too. So,
sure.
So the next category that I looked at was community. And this is something we've talked a lot about, but I'm just wondering if people are going to become a lot more comfortable with the absence of intimacy, the absence of others. And
there's a lot of people already pretty much that's
well,
their life experience.
Well, that may well be, but I think it may be a generational thing. I ask myself, is there a reason that we can't do this online? I think that's what we're asking now, but at some point I think we're going to say, is there a reason we need to do this online? And I think that question will flip itself. And or is there a reason, you and I have asked this early on, but we're not doing it anymore, is this necessary to meet with this person? Or is this necessary to take this risk? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's going to carry over into the future a bit. Also, one of the things that I like to think about is that with all of this need to be healthier and think about how 400,000 people have died and perhaps some of them needlessly, that maybe we're going to move to begin to think patriotism is about cultivating health and life in my community versus going in as a country and bombing people. And I think that...
So you're basically, how do you redefine patriotism?
Yeah. And how do we move from demilitarization to a military that's working in communities and not that some of them don't, but that that's their major role and not that we're going to go out and blow up our community because somebody is protesting. They don't like, you know, the fact mm-hmm. that Black people are being killed. So also as far as community that we could do a lot better around housing and shelter. The government could have avoided all these evictions and the stuff that's going to come now from all of the craziness around the economics and and not really giving money to where it makes a difference.
But do you really feel like these things are going to be widely adopted? I mean, this sounds like a bit of a liberal utopia where you say, okay, let's change our focus from, you know, corporations are going to be the job creators and the money makers, and getting away from that and saying, you know what, the true money makers, the true job creators is keeping our society healthy and happy.
Right. Well, that's what we've sort of purported to say all along.
You've been preaching that for a long time. I just question whether society is going to take that lesson, because I guess my cynical nature is our society doesn't seem to be able to learn lessons easily.
Okay. So, but here's one thing. While that's going on over there, there's a lot of other stuff going on over here. And one of the really great things about this is lots of young people coming along.
Sure, yeah.
And they have different views on these kinds of things. And one of the things is that there's a lot of talk right now about forgiving student loans. And if we were to do that, and that would be coming out of this, the student loan collection has been frozen for a little while. That could change a lot for anybody that's under, say, 40 years old in terms of their economics and how they live their life and in trying to service that student loan debt. So I think we have to say that we can take a snapshot of all these things I'm saying today, but they are not uniquely just sitting there. They are connected to a whole lot of things that intersect with them around rural and poverty and wealth and all the other stuff that comes into it, and that we're at a point in our history where we have a moment to maybe do something better, something more equal, more parity in life.
And again, you could make the argument with the student loans and education in general that a well-educated populace is an economic engine.
Absolutely. You know, although we haven't seemed to like that, because we don't want everybody to be too smart. But we are at a point where we are at a pause culturally, and that we have an opportunity, because we have this window that's been open to us that shows amazing disparity. I mean, we can't look away right now, and we haven't been able to for the last year or so. And now we can do something about it. We have the ability to stop paying the corporations and invest that money back into our culture.
Okay. So I guess I'm thinking about in the recent history, we experienced in 2008 a calamity that demonstrated that if left to their own devices, the financial world, the Wall Street and the banks, will create a ruinous situation that puts the entire world economy on the brink of disaster. And we had a moment to change things and we didn't.
Okay, but I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. But let me just finish. I think we don't have a choice right now about this pause button that we have the ability to hit, because the rich and the well-connected and the well-resourced communities they've proven we're taken care of. We are belly aching. We don't like the fact we got to cook at home.
Thank goodness. I was worried about
that. Well, yeah. But then on the other end of that is that the poor and the stigmatized communities have basically been destroyed. And so we've got to take some kind of sort of bailout and mobilize quickly, because only if we don't do this, if we don't recognize this, what we end up with is this 20% of people who have what they need. So they have broadband and they can work at home. Their kids have their own room so they can study at home. Mm-hmm. And they have all the resources.
Yeah, I've met some of those people.
And then the other 20%, which are the ones that are going to be, and forgive me, but this is the only way I can think to put it, a drain on society instead of contributing, is that we have to recognize that we have some things at our disposal right now that we could do something about.
So basically what you're saying is, like Winston Churchill said, right? Americans will always do the right thing, but only after they've exhausted every alternative.
All right, so here's a better one.
Well, I'm going to stop you a second because I want to tell everybody that you're listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you that it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
All right, and you're telling us, all right, things have gotten so bad that change is not only possible. It's mandatory.
All right. So because what we need to do is to reorient our politics and make investment in the public goods. And so the reason that we have a chance to see maybe some change in this is that that person that gets paid, you know, minimum wage to create this cheap burger for you in a restaurant is denied paid sick leave. And so they come to work and they spread germs and they cause a lot of issues because they have no, they're so vulnerable. They don't have any fallback and they have to go to school or they have to go to work. They don't have a choice. Whereas those 20% that are at the top of the heap, they have these things as options.
Okay, so I'm going to get you off some of the economics to go on to the
others.
Wait,
I want to say
the okay, I'm not going to get you
no,
off of
that. the reason that we need to do this is to recognize that some of the reasons that we are fighting this pandemic is because of how we do these things, because we insist on eating meat every meal. We insist on burning rainforest. This is all coming back all right. to how the germs and the microbes and everything have to sustain themselves when you disrupt climate and you just, I mean,
okay,
it really
I would
does
say
come
that
back
is
to
a contributing factor, but let's not assume it's the sole factor.
No, I'm not saying that. Right. I'm saying there's this chain of things that are leading to why we are really driven to make some of these changes during this pause okay, that we can take.
So it sounds like, okay, this is good. We're now having it sort of thrown in our face that all of these arguments that have been made by one side of the argument for many, many years, that the social good is really the social good, that everybody benefits from a healthy, well-educated, well-fed, well,
people who feel
fit.
Safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of these things benefit everybody versus, you know, you're in it for yourself and the cream will rise to the top kind of thing and who cares about the rest. So you're saying, okay, we've had it sort of thrown in our face that argument don't hold water.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's good as far as economics. What things as far as culture, you know, are we going to hold on to?
Well, science is back with a big bang. And
prove it.
and boom, people have come out of the dark again and said, we need science. It's the one thing that we can try to hang our hat on. And so there's science and that being an expert, that not being an expert, but expertise, people have knowledge, true knowledge. Are important. It's not just because you speak louder or longer yeah. or you have
so
more power.
So how's that going to manifest it? Because I guess I have a personal theory here, and that seems to be what everybody has, but that the internet, you know, the internet's a fairly new thing, and social media is even more recent. And what we've been dealing with here recently is sort of a tsunami of misinformation. And because as a society and worldwide, we're just not ready to deal with this new medium.
Okay, but wait, the human brain actually has been proven in science that it cannot handle all of that information
sure.
all at the same
but
time.
But I guess historically, I would look back to the early days of widespread newspapers, and we had kind of the same thing. We had the yellow journalism and the muckrakers and all this other stuff. And eventually it became a more mature medium where we could sort of assume with a legitimate newspaper that you were going to get something close to the facts. Well, today we've got the internet where we simply cannot assume we're going to get anything close to the facts. But will this whole world that we've been living in recently push that maturing process to social media? Will that be one of the impacts?
I don't know. But what I do know is that people are getting a lot more serious about a lot of things. And so today, even the people that are on the side that don't believe the virus exists or don't believe in science are able to articulate slightly things about the virus
sure,
that
better,
are
better at spewing their misinformation.
That's right. But
oh,
they,
good.
But they still have picked up some of the science, whether they wanted to or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so Americans are, I think, are going to return to a more serious. It's going to be sort of a mixture of being very serious about, you know, we want to know the vaccine works. We're not going to just take it because somebody stood up and said it's good for you. And we're also going to go crazy having fun. And
we're
definitely going to do that. And I'll talk more about that.
Okay, but so from a society standpoint, okay, so let's tick off the one and say people will not take at face value without some sort of corroboration, scientifically or otherwise.
And, and some of that is what this stuff intersects, like I said before. So some of that has to do with how we're educating our kids and making sure that they are taught to think and sort out information and really say, does this belong in my head or not?
Okay, so now tell us how we're going to party like it's 1999.
Okay, well, I don't know about that, but I do think that there's going to be a huge push towards parkland and community green space and people being outdoors and flying kites and doing all kinds of cool things because they've rediscovered that the outdoors is a safe, wonderful place to be. Yeah. But I want to talk about religion.
Okay. No, I want to finish on that thing because I've been thinking, you know, we've always heard about the Roaring Twenties, and I just wonder how much of the Roaring Twenties was a reaction to basically the Spanish flu pandemic and World War One. So you had multiple years of this sort of societal trauma, and then you're released from it and you go partying. So are we going to experience something like that over the next coming decade where it's just kind of a hedonistic world of excess?
I tell you, I don't think so, because there were other things in play. First of all, a lot of people got rich from World War One. And secondly, women had really an escape from, they had appliances, electrical appliances like a vacuum and things
I didn't want to get too deep into
that. But I'm so just telling you, everything intersects.
Go on to religion.
Yeah, so religion has had a real struggle during COVID-19. And part of that is that religion as a group has had a struggle. Normally, when we look back over history, one religion or another might be in a struggle position. And so part of it is that people haven't been allowed to have access to their regular routines of going to church or engaging in social activities at church. And so there's been some real changes in practice. And so a lot of things online, a lot of things about interconnected humanity and how people work together. And so it's changed how religion is being dealt with. And I don't think it's going to go back to everybody goes to service on Sunday that goes to church. I think that religion groups realize that we need to be online. We need to get that out there for people that are, you know, needing to stay home. And a lot of older people are learning how to use the internet because they want to have that access.
Sure. I think you can sort of extend that to a lot of different areas. Like religion was based on a face-to-face interaction. Education was face-to-face. Entertainment was face-to-face. And now we've been thrown into a remote learning, remote worship, remote entertainment. And maybe when we come back, we don't go back to where we were. We come back to a hybrid situation where there's some interaction face-to-face, some remote face-to-face, basically a second business model.
Yeah. Well, I think entertainers, you know, they tend to be hedonists anyway. And so they want to have that human being in front of them, and so their world has fallen apart for people that didn't.
But I think there's a medium, especially as we get into better technology with artificial realities, things of that nature. We've seen some entertainers who make their whole living on TikTok and on
right, but this takes a certain amount of creativity and perhaps even superficial entertainment.
Yeah, well, that's America, baby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so education has faced a lot of changes in recent years, and I think the pandemic has just pushed all of its vulnerability front and center. And so what's going to happen is nobody's going to put the education piece back in the jar, because a lot of people want to continue to learn from home and work from home. And the same is going to be true of work. And so a lot of companies see they can save a lot of money by having people work from home, telecommute, as they say, and they see that the person is just as productive and has a lot of a lot fewer issues by them working from home.
Well, before you get off education, because of course that's one of my pet peeves, but it seems like the educational world, amongst everything else in our society, has failed the pandemic miserably. I mean, basically, the model we've adopted is we will pretend to teach and you pretend to learn, and then we'll just call it even, you know? And so they've got to, I know there are lessons to be learned. I'm just skeptical that the education world has learned those lessons.
Well, I don't think they have. And I'll tell you why, because when we look at the disparity of the socioeconomics of this and that 20% that has their nice house with their broadband, and then we've got all these kids in rural areas or in homes that can't afford access to technology, and then we're all going to be expecting that those kids are going to learn in a way where the people that live in the more expensive neighborhoods can afford either childcare that help the kids, or they work from home and can do it. But the people in the other rung, the other 80%, are not to that advantage. So the kids really are going to suffer, and this is going to cost us a lot economically as a society. So, but it's ripe for innovation. We need educators to stop thinking the way they've always thought, because that's insanity right now. Stop it. Come forward and say, let's engage with people like me who are really cool at, you know, saying, let's examine this upside down, sideways, inside out, and see what it really is capable of versus the same old crap.
Yeah. And you've got to change how you measure education.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Because testing just is not a good way.
So I just want to say we have a lot more things we could talk about, but let's just talk about virtual reality.
Okay, in the final minute or so.
Yes, because virtual reality lends itself to what you brought up earlier about, are we going to go crazy with partying? And I think we're going to go crazy with escapism. I don't think it's going to be crazy with let's go camping and hang out, you know, and play volleyball. I think we're going to say the world is so tough and so fast and shoving so much at us at the same time that we want this virtual reality. We want to create our own reality. And I think it's going to be horribly dangerous. I'm sure there are advantages, but I having trouble figuring out what they are.
Yeah, I think there's a way of selling it. Of course, we've gone to remote shopping, remote education, remote entertainment, and virtual reality is like the crack cocaine of the next decade or so. I think you're right there. But I think also what we're going to find is, once again, just as many of the people start catching up with the broadband thing, you know, parts of rural America is really dealing with dial-up. When urban America has broadband, well, urban America is going to get virtual reality, and rural America is maybe going to get to broadband. So that's going to be a haves and have-nots situation. Once again, a whole new, you know, world.
It already is that situation.
Yeah, well, it's perpetual. We're always one technology behind.
But this is also an opportunity for the government, because if the government does not step in like they did with Rural Electric and force the corporations to provide much needed services for families and even medical people and things like that in rural areas, the disparities that we've seen through elections, through services, through advantages and disadvantages are just going to widen.
Okay, well, on that happy note, you have been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Andy Warmke. We want to thank our Emmy Award virtual producer, Adam Rich, and thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and go for a walk today.
Till next time.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.